Living Transplant is a podcast that takes you behind the scenes at the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital with the goal to educate, inspire, and fuel your passion about transplant. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. I'm thrilled to have you join me for season 5. In this episode of the Living Transplant podcast, I was joined by Stephanie Drew, a living liver donor to her son. Stephanie was put in a situation no parent could ever imagine when her healthy 3.5-year-old son crashed into liver failure with no warning within days. Stephanie and the UHN team worked tirelessly to get the testing done in partnership with SickKids to test to find if she would be a match. And thankfully, within mere days, Stephanie became a living liver donor to her son, saving his life. We're later joined by Dr. Nazia Selzner, a transplant hepatologist and medical director of the Living Donor Liver Transplant Program at the Ijmera Transplant Center, an associate professor of medicine at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Cynthia Sin, education director of the Ijmera Transplant Center and assistant professor of medicine. We spoke about diversity, equity, and inclusion in transplant, both for professionals and for patients and families. We discussed how equity, diversity, and inclusion in transplant medicine are crucial to ensuring all patients have fair access to life-saving treatments, regardless of their background, leading to better overall health outcomes, and how for professionals, fostering an inclusive environment enhances teamwork, broadens perspectives, and improves decision-making, ultimately advancing the field and providing more comprehensive care. Please enjoy. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. I am thrilled to have Stephanie Drew with me here today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Candace. Really happy to be here.
So I'm wondering if we can go back a few years and start at the beginning of your journey with transplant and how you got involved in the world of transplant, knowing about liver failure, all of these things that have brought you to where you are now and all of the amazing work that you do and outreach that you do in the community.
Yeah, Candace, it's so interesting because it feels like forever ago, but also like it just happened. So November 2021 is where we, you know, very honestly would have been first introduced to transplant, and my then 3.5-year-old son would have been, you know, a very ordinary, active, healthy little boy, no preconditions or sort of any real health history that was notable in a good way. Noticed a little bit of yellow in the corner of his eyes. And at that point in time, we were actually living quite literally across the street from SickKids Hospital. So literally took him into emergency room at SickKids. And sort of for frame of reference, I always think of, you know, my biggest concern was like, what the heck am I going to do with an active 3.5-year-old boy in emergency, you know, as they do tests and sort of check in on these things. That night, his INR number, by the time results came back, it was evening, was slightly elevated, was how they positioned it. And so as a precautionary measure, they were going to admit us to watch that number. Never, you know, a good thing for a parent. You never want your child admitted into hospital, but certainly didn't feel urgent and absolutely didn't feel critical. So it was, you know, did feel very ordinary. We were in general peds at that time. And the next sort of few days were sort of watch and wait. And I always think it was a Wednesday night we were admitted. Thursday, his dad came into hospital. I went to work. So that sort of puts into reference, I think, my urgency around this. So he was with him during the day and we were doing lots of blood tests and sort of going through things. But it was really just that INR number that was elevated at that time. And so as they kept watching it, it didn't decline. And so every sort of test, it slightly went up. Again, sort of seemed like nothing to be super concerned about. And we kept hearing or understanding that like that number, especially in kids, can sort of just correct itself. And so that was sort of the hope and what we were waiting for. Didn't quite happen. And then by Saturday morning, a doctor had come in and said, hey, we're going to actually send you now to GI. And so we moved from general peds to GI. And the liver specialist had come to see us at that point in time. The word transplant, very honestly, was used. And, you know, if things don't, because it's liver, and because he's, you know, experiencing these symptoms and that INR is not declining, if, you know, we don't figure this out or sort of this number doesn't drop, transplant will be, you know, something we consider. And I think for his dad and I, it sort of felt like this incredibly overwhelming, even just the word. And I think our, you know, notion of what transplant was and what that meant was very honestly very overwhelming. So it had gone from like, hey, this feels, you know, not urgent, to like transplant bomb. We started to kind of meet with doctors at, you know, sort of a little bit more testing, ruling things out, like genetic disorders, things like that. Definitely started to feel different, and even his condition started to feel different. And then so Saturday we did a liver biopsy, I believe it was Saturday or Sunday. But that is definitely when you could sort of sense the decline and sense the change in health, and even just sort of the behavior of the medical staff and teams. And then Sunday morning, you know, just based on, I suppose, the biopsy and results from that, it became apparent that, you know, whatever was happening, he was in acute liver failure at that time, and like didn't feel like time was something we had on our side. So, you know, transplant became the only option for us. And so immediately he was listed on the National Registry for Deceased Donation. And I think at that time, because, you know, his age and critical status, he would have been listed very high, if not the highest. And so we were sort of waiting for that, but in fear that a deceased donor wouldn't come through, living donation was brought forward. The on-call doctor was brought over from UHN to talk to us about that and sort of let us know what the steps would be. So everything just felt like, and then through sort of general questions from Dr. Mark Cottrell, who was the on-call doctor from UHN, sort of what living donation was going to be and, you know, who would be a good candidate likely between his dad and I just sort of like immediately was able to fill out the forms and get that process started. And then Monday was tested to be a living donor, and the incredible teams both at SickKids and UHN, when I think of just the coordination it would have taken, you know, both teams to be able to get me through those tests so quickly. I did that in one day, and then Tuesday we were in the OR. So it was certainly a whirlwind. And at that point, definitely by Sunday night, Monday, his health was declining rapidly. And just to watch that change and being so hopeful, you know, on just pushing through these tests to get him into the OR, because it was, you know, definitely getting scary, and watching him truly fight his life at that point.
Well, bring me back to that moment that the team comes in after the biopsy and they tell you that he's going to be listed for a liver transplant on the deceased donor list, but that it might not come in time and that living donation is the best route for your son. But what did that feel like in that moment to be told you may have to step forward and do this for your son?
I'll never forget. So it was early Sunday morning, very early, and it was an entire team of doctors who came in to sort of share this news. And I think the hardest part, very honestly, is I had JP on my lap in his hospital bed. And so not even really, or being very mindful of how I was reacting to that news to not sort of create panic for him was incredibly difficult. And I think, you know, because of some of just my ignorance in this and things happening so fast and not having the time to research, it actually all of a sudden something that, you know, maybe didn't seem urgent. It was like, I realized at that moment, if this doesn't happen, my son is going to die. And so to even have that sort of epiphany moment, the fear that comes with that, sort of the urgency that comes with that, and you know, so it was a tough moment, and definitely, you know, to have your son listed, a 3.5-year-old healthy boy, you know, what felt like just a couple of days ago was shocking. I, you know, just the shock that sort of set in at that point. I get goosebumps even thinking about that moment, and, you know, knowing that we were sort of waiting for something, at least stepping forward felt like taking action. And so I think there was also, you know, hope around what can we do? How can we move this forward? But yeah, everything just sort of felt so urgent for a lot. Like it was that, just like this criticalness and trying to move things as fast as we possibly could.
Most people get the chance to hear about the need for an organ, think through it, go through these steps, talk to family members, make a decision. You, on the other hand, are sitting in the bed with your son and they're telling you what needs to happen and you just jump to do it. What kind of information did you have about living donation at that point? Did you really understand what you were signing up for?
No, definitely not. I think certainly to be very, very honest, and I'm almost, you know, embarrassed to share this, but a kidney living donation, I sort of had some frame of reference, like understood that you had two kidneys and that you could give one away. But to be very honest, liver, I didn't even realize you could donate a portion of your liver. So I think because so much information was thrown at me, I don't think it was until, and I sort of remember walking over with the social worker, Maria, who was on JP's team from Sick Kids, they walked me through the tunnel. And again, you're just like being bombarded with so much information because it was just happening so quickly. Right. I think it was not until I got into Toronto General to do my first test that I realized that I was going to live. And so I remember filling out the forms and actually thinking that they were taking my liver. And again, a bit ignorant and embarrassing when I think back, but they sort of turned to me and were like, no, you live. Like, we would not do this. And as a mother, it didn't even, absolutely wouldn't have stopped me. But it was like, that was my frame of reference. It was like anything to save my baby boy. I mean, I was quite literally watching him die. So it didn't even think, and then to realize like, wow, I actually know nothing about this procedure. I have no idea what I'm going in for. And then I sort of think telling my surgical team, again, walking into the OR alone on Tuesday morning, when they asked me if I had done surgery, I told them I had my wisdom teeth out. And I was right. Like, oh, I was a champ. You know, I'm really good at this. And they're like, this is not the same. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think the fact that I was, you know, not that I was thinking it was going to be the same, but certainly had no idea and definitely didn't have time to process.
For people listening, we've talked about this before. Normally, only about 1 in 5 people who step forward can actually be a donor. So, I mean, the fact that this happened so quickly and you were the donor is miraculous. But when did you find out that you were going to go through this and you were the match for him?
Yeah, the day of testing, again, I mean, you know, it was hard enough to just leave JP that day in such an awful state. And, you know, with all of the sort of needs that he had at that time and kind of watching him fade. So that was a huge challenge, even just being away from him for those hours. And I probably would have left Sick Kids Hospital about 8 a.m., got walked over to UHN. And they just put me quite literally through the test one by one by one. And I remember thinking, you know, it felt like a bit of a video game. And I would call up to the 12th floor and then they would sort of send me to the next test because they were trying to find X-ray machines and MRI machine, all these things that were available to pop me or slot me into. And again, a mom, when your baby is sick, you're not sleeping, you're not eating. So also knowing that I wasn't in my sort of optimal state, I would say, and just the anxiety and stress of it. So my last test was my MRI, and I'll never forget just sort of the people on the day, like just kind people, even porters who were taking me to appointments, you know, so many people that I think were part of our journey that I'm so grateful for. And the team couldn't, I was so dehydrated and hadn't eaten, they couldn't find a vein for the MRI, and I was doing everything, you know, to try, because at that point I knew sort of the last piece also just to get back to my baby. So quite literally ran from my MRI was at Princess Margaret. It was a wet, cold November night in this, you know, little shirt, ran across the street to Sick Kids to figure out if I was in fact a match. Cause I don't think, you know, I knew time wasn't on our side. And I knew that like my hope was as every hour went by, if we missed the surgery for the next day, I sort of had that feeling of like, you know, is he going to make it? Is he going to be able to pull through another night? So my big piece was like, I just hope I'm a match and I hope we're going. And I heard from his day nurse, who was sort of incredible to us. And she herself was a mom and just kind of this stable. She kind of grabbed me and embraced me. His dad was there, of course, too, and said, Mom, I think we're going. I think you're a match. And I remember just crying so hard. And she said, Dr. Cottrell is on his way. And he's going to tell you what's going to happen next. And just sort of those moments, I believe he was even wrapping up a surgery and we're sort of waiting for him to come from surgery. And yeah, a few minutes later, he came in the door and told us at that point, I just remember they didn't have ORs booked and even the coordination of that. And he said, we'll see you at Toronto General at 6 a.m. tomorrow. Check yourself in. And just knowing that we were doing it and praying that like that was sort of the piece, let's get through the night and get into that OR the next day.
That's, yeah, that's a lot to just stay strong and push through and just do it because you're his mom, you know what has to be done, and you're the one who's going to do it. How did you feel when they told you that you were his donor and that it was happening tomorrow?
You know, there was hope that we were hopefully going to get into that OR and just the gratitude of, you know, the coordination, the teams, the fact that I was healthy enough and was a match for him, just, you know, hope and gratitude for sure were sort of the big pieces that, okay, like that was the biggest hurdle to overcome and we are sort of almost there. So just so overwhelmed, probably even just joy at that point, which is interesting thing. That, you know, to feel joy in that state, but certainly, you know, just the excitement of having that big piece.
And did JP know what was going on? Did he, as a 3.5-year-old, it's hard to understand what's happening. Was there a way that you explained to him what you were going to do and why you wouldn't be with him and those types of things?
To be honest, Candace, I think at that point, like he was slipping. And so for sure, I would have been talking out loud to him and, you know, I in bed with him the whole night. And I guess these are the moments that are so hard to think back to. And, but I think my constant message to him at that point was like, you know, that he couldn't go anywhere and that I needed him. And so it wasn't even about what mommy was going to do. It was like, you know, his fight and that he needed to pull through the night. I mean, that last night before our surgery, every 30 minutes they were in our room just to check vitals. Like that's how critical it was. And so when I think back to that and, you know, even them pinching his toes and the, you know, resuscitation orders everywhere, and, you know, you, I think during those couple of days you saw one that is sort of standard and then all of a sudden you see them posted everywhere. And, you know, just that feeling of watching and feeling sort of helpless in that, right? Watching your baby fade away. So those were definitely the tough moments. So I think for him, it was just basking him with love and encouragement and reminding him, you know, we need you, little guy. Don't go anywhere.
And that morning when you had to leave him, was there something that you said to him before you left or did?
For sure, some of the toughest moments, if not the toughest moment of my life. I mean, I remember getting into the shower. So a team came in. I was up. I didn't sleep, I don't think, the entire night. But nurse came in and reminded me, like, you know, you got to get out of here soon. It was probably 5 a.m. because I needed to check in at 6. And, you know, they brought me a care kit so that I could shower and stupid stuff, but like wash my hair and do stuff before going into surgery. And I remember just praying that that wasn't the last time I was going to see my baby and just getting into bed with him and, you know, telling him how much I loved him and reminding him that I was going to do it and I was going to see him. And I'm sure I said to him that mommy was going to save him and he just had to hold on.
Pretty amazing what you're able to do in those moments and be able to pull yourself to together and walk over and check yourself in to do the most remarkable thing that you're going to do in your life, right?
Definitely. And even that, like, I think because of COVID and all, like to have to do that alone,
right?
You know, and make that walk with my little bag and sort of go over, but it is, we are capable of incredible things. All of us are.
So they brought you in, you had the surgery. How did that surgery go?
Yeah, I think that it's amazing. I think the human, you know, connection, I think, you know, strangers greeting me all along that journey, being alone and just sort of the kindness and care I felt from people. And, you know, I can't believe how helpful people were at, you know, being wheeled into the OR. And, you know, as they were putting me out, it was just like,
you know, and I didn't care what happened to me. And I think it was, you know, just like, take what you need and just save them and sort of begging. I remember as a mom, like, you know, being reassured that I would be okay, but it was like, I didn't even care. I mean, I cared so that he had a mother, but it was,
right,
you know, certainly further down the list when I think of just him being safe and being healthy. So yeah, I definitely remember kind of those moments leading up literally to being out and then sort of waking up and again having no real regard for my well-being. All I wanted to know was, you know, if the surgery was successful. And I think the first thing that really kind of, you know, as I was coming to and a little bit more aware, the only thing I sort of realized is when I understood in the pain, it was, again, interestingly enough, gratitude and joy. Even though I was in this crazy pain and overwhelmed by that, it was like, they did it. They took my liver, which means he is going to be okay.
How quickly were you able to go and see him after your surgery?
Yeah, that was the hardest part. So not having any contact and again, not having a strong reference of what was happening and no time to process. And then, you know, being focused on my own recovery at that point, and had a couple of sort of tough moments for sure post-surgery and in the immediate sort of days. I went in on a Tuesday and Saturday. Dr. Selznick was actually the one who signed my release forms. And there was a few things that I remember sort of pleading with her, like, I just want to get to SickKids to see my son. And she sort of let me out, and I'm forever grateful to her for that. But getting wheeled, like I couldn't even walk over to SickKids at that point, getting wheeled over to SickKids also through the tunnel. And then seeing him and just having that sort of, he was doing well, and seeing him was phenomenal. And just, you know, I was weak and couldn't do a lot, but just laying in bed with my baby felt like, you know, the best thing in the world.
And knowing that you were able to do that, I always say that my mom gave me life twice. You were able to give your baby that as well. How did that feel laying in that bed with him, knowing that you guys were going to be okay?
Yeah, it's funny. It's still sort of hard to connect that. It's for me, I think any mother and Kenneth, you would know yourself, like you would just do anything for your kid. So I don't even think it ever was any about anything that I had done, or, you know, I'm not even sure I've thought about it much like that. Just him being okay was really all that mattered. So not sure it would have mattered, you know, what my recovery would have been, or even what long-term effect. I mean, there is no negative health effects, but even if there were, I would stop me from doing it. So, but definitely appreciating, you know, like, to your point, like recovery is actually quite short for a surgery like that. You know, my current health is phenomenal. So just seeing him happy and healthy and, you know, thriving is like, what a blessing.
So thinking about him, those final days compared to the first time that he got to go back to playing soccer or the first day back to school, what was that difference like being able to see him hit those milestones and seeing him healthy and happy again?
Surreal is the best way to put it. Like, he had never been sick, and you know, sort of they suspect, they still have no real data or, you know, understanding of exactly what happened. So they sort of ruled out everything and believe it was a virus. So even having that unknown is tough. It can be tough at times. And, you know, it feels a bit unfair, like, why us? Or, you know, it took a while to get out of the spin of like, was it this? Was it this? Did we, you know, and I think not having that frame of reference of not having him sick or time to deal with it. But then again, you know, being just grateful that we were having these moments with him, we had him home, was unbelievable. And I see him now, like, he's truly just like a normal kid in a lot of regards. So he'll live with this for life, but at the same time is living his best life. So it's incredible to see.
It's amazing. So with everything that you had been through, it wasn't a very long time between that surgery and when we connected about living donation and starting to look to create a campaign about this, because you brought forward the fact that you didn't know much about living donation at the time, and you co-own a marketing company, and you thought, here's a good idea to spread some awareness to the public. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about kind of the genesis of the Great Actions campaign and how your experience going through this really sparked that creative idea?
So it would have been, I think, literally a month or two. I was definitely still post-op, kind of at home with my computer, reaching out to the center, sort of saying, hey, I'd like to do some work around this. And some of it, I think, that sort of drew me forward. I think both myself and Daniele, my business partner, you know, have always been very interested in, you know, doing work that's meaningful and that truly does contribute to, like, you know, the betterment of the world and even the most macro sense. So it just felt like an important kind of thing to rally behind and get the agency behind, and sort of twofold. I think definitely feeling a bit of that ignorance of, like, I didn't know. I would say I'm a relatively educated woman, and, you know, I'm well traveled to a certain degree, and I had no idea that you could donate a portion of your liver. So that was a big catalyst, and, like, more people do need to know about this, and how can we, of course, share that awareness and celebrate this? Like, just think, even to put into perspective the hard work of these people, and then realizing, you know, there's other people waiting on this list. There's people who might not have access, who might not be matches. Like, what is their outcome? So really appreciating, like, if I can do this, anybody can do it. And we're saving people's lives. So all sort of part of the catalyst and wanting to share these stories. They're remarkable, both for recipient and donor. Like, I really think of, you know, the transplant community as being this, you know, hidden gem, I suppose, in modern medicine in general.
Talk to me about your scar and how that kind of fueled the idea behind showing off our scars and the name Great Actions Leave a Mark, the mark as the scar.
Yeah, I think it just sort of, you know, was something, you know, that felt really profound. And as a liver sort of donor, it's sort of a significant scar, I would say, on my body that, you know, like, in a, as a woman, you're in bikinis, you're in sort of stuff, and showing that part of your body. So it's quite prevalent, I suppose. And then realizing, like my body will forever have this mark. This will never go away. And this memory will never go away. And this experience will never go away. And sort of, you know, for anybody who goes through, you know, any type of adversity, you know, it always leaves a mark, and whether that's literal or metaphorical. And so just sort of leaning into that a little bit and recognizing that, like, we are forever changed, and what a beautiful thing. You know, these marks are incredible, incredible sort of moments for us of things that we're able to overcome, and sort of hopefully inspire other people in their own way to do things that are incredible.
With this campaign, we talk a lot about the donors and the impact that they have on our lives. My mom saved my life. You saved your son's life. Many strangers step forward to donate to people they've never met because they're inspired to support someone else. And we have a large group of anonymous living kidney and donors at UHN. For the general public who doesn't know a lot about transplant and maybe has some myths there that might be similar to what you were thinking when you were going through this process, what would you want them to know about living donation, either liver or kidney?
You know, the misconception perhaps of that, of who is a transplant recipient. And I think, you know, that's part of what inspired the campaign, but even for myself to continue to speak on this. Transplant is everybody. The face of transplant is everybody. And any of us can fall victim to something happening to us that would affect an organ, to need or require an organ. So I think just this misconception of, you know, who maybe needs transplant, or sort of this idea of, like, well, why would I give my organ? You know, and I think it's really important to reframe that, and so that people recognize that transplant is kids, transplant is babies, transplant is everybody in between. It, you know, doesn't have, you know, a look or a type or someone that it goes after. And so I think it's really important to sort of recognize that. And I think the campaign has a remarkable job at showcasing that, you know, who really the face of transplant is. So I think that's probably one of the biggest pieces I'd sort of reinforce. It's not necessarily who you think. And, you know, people cannot be a donor and for many different re or yeah, donor for many reasons. So, you know, if it's your child, if it was your baby, you know, I think we would all be wanting someone to step forward. So I always sort of think of that. And I think of these anonymous donors and, you know, just my gratitude, even though they didn't donate to my son, it makes me truly like weep when I think like these are the heroes. Because, you know, if I wasn't a match, would there have been someone who potentially could have matched with my son? So, you know, it takes people to really sort of consider. And if you're in good health and, you know, there's no reason why you can't. It's, you know, certainly the most profound thing I think I'll ever do in my life.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing your personal journey and for all of the incredible work that you've been doing. We truly appreciate it and so happy and grateful that you and your son are doing so well as well.
Same. Thank you. Thank you for being part of it.
It is now my absolute pleasure to have Dr. Nazia Selzner and Dr. Cynthia Sin join me. I'm going to start with Nazia. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what you do at UHN.
Absolutely. So I am a transplant hepatologist at the Admiral Transplant, and which means that I do see patients who are in need of liver transplant, before liver transplant, and while they are waiting for transplantation, and obviously after they got their liver transplant, I do take care of them. So that's my role as a transplant hepatologist. And I'm also the medical director of the liver donor program. And in my capacity, in this role, I interact and see all the everyone who steps forward basically to be a donor. I oversee their evaluation, and when they have finished with their donation, I do follow them post-donation for an extended period of time.
Amazing. And yourself, Cynthia, can you tell us a little bit about your role?
Absolutely. So my name is Cynthia Tsien, and I'm a colleague of Nazia Selzner. And so I also see patients before and after liver transplant. And then I'm also the education director at Ajmera Transplant Center. And I'm quite heavily involved in training the up-and-coming doctors, the residents, the fellows who are going to be taking care of us in the future. So we have quite a few training programs, and I am the fellowship director specifically for the liver transplant program on the medical side. And then I am involved in education, kind of like for all the physicians, the surgeons,
Wow.
trainees, looking at educational programs for them. And then also, we do education for patients. So that's some initiatives that we're starting now to improve the education that we give to patients moving forward. And I just also want to say, like, it sounds like I do a lot, but actually, it's a whole entire team.
I think you probably do a lot, but you also have a great team with you, right? That's what I would think. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I like about the job is I get to work with a lot of different people.
That's awesome. Nazia, I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about your clinical research and what interested you in access to liver transplant and living donor liver transplant.
So when it comes to the living donor program, I truly believe that's the really the jewel of liver transplantation. And without the living donor program, sustainability of liver transplantation, at least in programs like ours in Canada, is almost impossible. The reason for that is that, you know, the number of patients in need of a liver transplant is growing due to the success of the surgery and to the success of the medical care of this patient after transplant that allows for this recipient to live for many, many, many years. However, despite the growth and the growing need of liver transplant, there is simply not enough organ to meet really the need of all the patients for liver transplant. And there is a gap that is not really filling. And the only way to be able to fill this gap was through living donation. So the fact that, you know, over 20, now 25 years ago, our program start looking into this option, which is liver transplant in practice, actually in the Eastern countries where the option of deceased donor does not exist. And our team went to East Far East to learn about the living donation and bring it here and allow the program to grow and reach to this level where we are the leader in Western countries. To me was extremely important, and I think without the living donors we would see a lot more mortalities and we would see a lot more patients unfortunately dying without having access to transplant.
Coming back to you, Cynthia. There's a very strong tradition at UHN of teaching and education, and the fellowship program here is one of the premier programs in the world. As the director, can you speak a little bit about the program and what makes it so unique?
We're a really large multi-organ program, and I think that's what makes us unique because, as I mentioned, I work with surgeons, I work with other organ groups, nephrologists, people from infectious diseases, respirologists. So that has been amazing to collaborate. Even though we're in different organ systems, there's a lot of similarities, and we can talk to each other, have new ideas, and collaborate. And I think also the really great thing about our program is that because we're such a large program, we attract people from all over the world. In our liver program alone, we have someone from Spain, we have people from the Middle East, we have people from Australia, we had someone recently from Singapore. So it's actually a little bit like the United Nations in our conference rooms. And it's really fantastic to see the experience of people all over the world because they definitely bring a lot of knowledge and their perspective to the training program. And then we also have the honor of showing what we do and having our fellows go all over the world to bring what they've learned back to their home countries. And I think, obviously, when you have people from all over the world, there are also challenges. And that's kind of what I think we're going to be speaking about this later, but Nazia and I are doing this conference in diversity, equity, inclusion. And I think a lot of that is brought about by the fact that we're realizing that we're very privileged to have people from all over the world. In reality, there can be conflict, there can be miscommunication. And I think it's really important to focus on giving people the tools to understand why this happened, improve the communication, have us work together better as a team. And so that's why we really thought about this conference because of our clinical experience. I think, you know, being able to provide that care to people from someone who's from their own culture, the patients really love it. And so I think it's a great strength of ours, and it's something we really want to nurture and grow.
So thinking about that conference, Nazia, coming back to you, can you tell us a little bit about this new conference? It's the first year you're doing this, and can you talk a little bit about what's going to happen there and why you've come together to make this happen?
Totally, yes. Indeed, this is the first ever Congress in advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion in transplantation. The idea started actually with Cynthia. We were having a meeting a bit over a year ago celebrating the Day of Women in Medicine. And we have a guest speaker from Alberta, Lori Best, and we had an amazing panel of people discussing the issues related to women careers in medicine and for what matters in transplantation. And we start saying, how about having a congress really focusing on challenges that transplant professionals, but also the transplant patients are facing. And the best way to do it is to bring together a group of international experts to sit down and talk about the issues and come with some proposal and some solution. And so the goal of this meeting is really to look at the challenges that is involved in really achieving diversity, equity, and inclusion for patient professionals and patients. When it comes to professional, it's really related to gender, sexual orientation, racial background in their work environment, all the inequities that some people face still even in this era in 2024 in terms of having access to leadership, for example, promotion, compensation, etc. And when it comes to patients, we all know that access to transplant, which is a life-saving procedure, is still very inequitable, even in a society like ours, where access to healthcare is free. However, there are many minorities, many communities that referrals of the patients or their access to transplantation is very, very low. And it's very important that we bring really teams of experts together to talk about all these issues and come with solutions that we can hopefully all implement. So knowing that, we invited really a whole panels of experts from all around the world, from all the way from Far East to Europe to North America, etc. These are all really in their own group, in their own area of expertise. And it's a two-day congress that will really tackle issues related to diversity, equity, and inclusion in transplantation.
That's incredible. And it's really inspiring to hear the passion in your voice about this and what's going to be happening. You touched a little bit about those barriers that some patients face. And sometimes we know some of the easier ones to think of. Like we may think about how difficult it is to drive to Toronto or to fly to Toronto if you have to get to there. But so, what are some of the other barriers in equity and inclusion for marginalized groups when looking at liver transplantation?
Yeah, I think that many of these patients are not even aware that they have liver disease, and that's already to start with the problem. They may not know because they are not seeing a physician in a regular basis. Part of it is language barrier, maybe cultural barrier, etc. And by the time they are aware of the fact that they have a liver disease, it may be very advanced. It may be a cancer that has spread outside the liver, and they may not be eligible anymore for transplantation. And I think that the first step is really acknowledging that many patients from marginal community, they may not have any idea that they have liver disease, and get cares that involves with liver disease and screening that involves for patients with advanced liver disease that could actually prevent them from needing a transplant. And then from there is again all the cultural barrier, language barrier when it comes to referral from there to the transplant center for consideration of liver transplant. So there are barriers along all the way, but it starts from even knowing that they have advanced liver disease and they need to be in care of liver specialists and liver transplant professionals.
And thinking about the professional side of this conference, Cynthia, can you talk a little bit about some of those challenges? You mentioned a couple that are involved in achieving diversity, equity, and inclusion in a professional setting, and how you're working towards that here at UHN.
So there's on the professional side, I think that it's really incredible the change, I would say, over the last 5 years, because this is not a new issue.
No.
So issues with women facing a glass ceiling, people feeling that they're missing out on promotions or things at work due to either their gender or their minority status. These are definitely not new issues. I think it's really incredible that over the last 5 to 10 years, people are finally talking about it. They're recognizing that it's an issue and that we're able to speak about these things because, as Nezia was saying, like this is going to be the first international conference like this. So the fact that in 2024, this is the first time that we're talking about this is pretty incredible. And so obviously it's been happening for a long, long time, but now we're finally addressing it. And I think also that change is very, very hard. Transplant is a very surgical-based subspecialty. And as we all know, in surgery, there is a lot of hierarchy. It's very difficult to go against people who are higher up on the hierarchy than you. And so this is why I think it's very difficult to make these changes, and why there's been issues with access to the same opportunities, regardless of who you are, where you come from. There's been lots and lots of research on all the challenges that exist, but I'm very hopeful about this because I think once we start talking about it and learning from our peers who have experienced it and gone through it and can give us like advice, I think it really is a giant step forward to starting to make changes. So an example is working with Nazia has been amazing because she is this strong person who has achieved so much. And so every day it's great to get her advice and see her example as a way to progress and achieve things at UHN. And I think we really need the conference will be another opportunity for us to see amazing leaders in transplant. How did they get there? Even having to encounter all of these difficulties, like it will be an amazing learning opportunity.
Now you make me really become red, Antoinette.
She's blushing.
It's the truth. Honestly, you can't do this without the example of people before. I mean, I talk a lot about being in a team. The only way things change is like more and more of us have to do this. When you're by yourself and you encounter the barriers, everybody encounters these barriers. Like in the professional world, you need someone to open the doors for you. You need someone to promote you. And we are all in this together. And very frankly, like it's not realistic to be able to do things without the help of other people. And so I think it's only by working together that we're going to change things.
If there was one of your fellows, or let's say even a high school student who looked at themselves and thought, I haven't really seen anybody who looks like me in a leadership role, what would you say to them?
I would say, look at Cynthia. She's the education director of the largest transplant program in Canada. And I'm sure there are many medical students that can identify themselves, or high school students that can identify themselves to Cynthia.
I would say that we have an incredible team at UHN. And if you look at the Ajmera Transplant Center, it's a reflection of our patient population, it's a reflection of our trainees. Again, that's one of the strengths of Ajmera Transplant Center is that we're a huge group. We all work together. And if I have a medical student or a trainee, they don't see themselves in the liver group, but I can walk them over and there's people in kidney, in lung, like We're an amazing multi-organ transplant group that truly is very, very international. And it's been amazing, like the support across organ groups. And I would tell them we have this fantastic program, the MOT-SRTP program, which welcomes in students who are interested in transplant. The leadership is diverse, the students are diverse. And I would tell them this is a fantastic opportunity to dip your toes into transplant, see how you like it. And honestly, the membership there is just amazingly diverse. And so they make people feel very welcome. And all the students that I've spoken to have had a fantastic experience.
So this is a really exciting conference that's coming. How do people get involved and how do they attend this conference?
People can register online. We can put the website link at the bottom of the podcast,
Yes, we will. We'll put it in the notes for everyone to
that'd be
click on.
great.
Yes, amazing.
So they can sign up for the conference online. They can register, and I think it would be a fantastic opportunity, as I mentioned, because there really are like the leaders of transplant are going to be there. It'll be an amazing opportunity to learn from these people who are the leaders, but also to understand the patient's concerns, because I think this is a extremely valuable opportunity to hear from patients and to understand what they see as important and to gain their perspective.
And thinking about that patient journey, both of you meet so many patients and so many donors, and you've had years now of all of these heartbreaking and also inspiring moments with people through this journey. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about either a recipient or a donor story that has stood out to you over the years. And maybe I'll start with you, Nazia.
I think I will talk maybe from a donor side, and maybe perhaps Cynthia can share experience from a recipient sides. Really, for me, it's always truly important, but also truly eye-opening to listen to these stories and interact with them. And they all resonate somewhere in my brain. But I think the one story that I think I would never forget, and that shows really the power of love, if you want to call it that way, of a mom who came forward to donate to their child, which, and that mom actually was under the impression or was willing to donate their whole liver to their child to save the child, knowing that if their whole liver come out, they won't be able to live themselves. And they were really willing to do that. And to me, that really shows how people are able to sacrifice anything. Yes, it's a mom and it's their child, but similar stories exist for across all age and across all relationships that people are willing to sacrifice and themselves, even if needed, give away their whole liver to save someone else. That is really, for me, inspiring and allow me to do every day what I'm doing.
That's beautiful. That's amazing. And what about yourself, Cynthia?
I would say, in terms of a specific patient, I would say the things that have popped out at me the last couple of months, and I thought was really timely, is I do feel like I do see a trend of patients speaking out more. Medicine has traditionally always been very hierarchical. And I think with this new trend towards diversity, equity, inclusion, patients as well are feeling like they can speak up and say, hey, I want to participate in these decisions. This is what's important to me. This is what I really want out of my healthcare treatment. And so I would say there are one or two patients that do spring to mind where they were bold enough to tell me, hey, I feel like we're not being partners and I want to be a partner and I want to have a say. And I would say that that was a wake-up call. It was eye-opening to me, and I really appreciated it, because I think there's probably a lot of patients who think that, but feel like they can't speak up. Really made me more aware of asking patients, making sure that we're partners rather than this hierarchical me telling people what to do.
That's amazing. As a patient myself who now works in the field, I have that boldness, I guess, I've been given because I have now worked with some of the people who actually literally saved my life and helped me with my dialysis or did the transplant. And now I'm sitting across the table from them discussing policies. I have a little bit more of a confidence to be around doctors and nurses and speak about my patient journey. But I think, like you said, it can be very intimidating. And we want to respect what our doctors are saying because you're the experts. So we want to listen and do what we're told. But you're right, once in a while, there's things that need to be said. And we may feel like it's scary to say those things. So to hear from you and Nausea and, the whole team at Ajmera, the interest in wanting to hear more from patients and be a partner in that care is so important and so empowering for us to know that we're in the right hands. So thank you so much for not just saying that, but putting that into practice because it just builds such comfort in being a patient and knowing that you're valued where you are. So before we head out, I'm wondering if there's anything else that we didn't discuss that you might want our listeners to know.
I think what I would like to end is by saying, inviting people and saying, hey, come learn more about transplant. Come work with us. We're very inclusive. We love hearing new ideas and how we can be better. And so if people want to work with us, we want you to come.
Thank you so much, Cynthia and Nausea, for being on the podcast and for all of the amazing work that you do for patients. And I'm really excited to participate in that conference that's coming up. I will put the link in the bio, but if people are listening and they can't read at the moment, they can go to DEIintransplant.com and learn more about the conference. Thank you so much, ladies. I really appreciate your time here today. And again, all of the efforts that you make in making our journeys as patients that much better.
Thank you
Thank
so
you,
much for
Nadez.
having us.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please leave us a review and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you are listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, you can reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca or on social at givelifeuhn. For more information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Lead Podcasting for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us. Thank you.